It is Your Money. Happy to have you with us, and Happy New Year. We're so happy to have you listening today as we jump right in head first, I'll say. Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor and senior vice president, Peg Webb and financial advisor, are ready to take your calls. We like to call this show Ask Bruce and Peg Anything. So welcome and Happy New Year to both of you, and hope you're well and rested after what's been a long 2 weeks of celebrations.
Well, happy New Year to you, Susie.
Thanks,
happy Peg. New Year, Bruce.
Yeah, happy 2026, Susie Jones, Peg Webb, everybody listening. It's a new year. And ladies, I just wanted to mention really quickly, you may or may not even be aware of this, but this is the beginning, actually, of the 30th season of Your Money. Demi Long and I started in January of 1997.
Wow.
My Olivia,
wow.
I know. I had a full head of hair, and it wasn't gray at that time. My Olivia High School math tells me that this is the beginning of the 30th season. So who knew? I thought I'd get thrown off the air in 6 months, but here we are 30 years later still doing it.
That's wonderful.
So fun. What a great stat. I joined the company in 1999, so that I would be 28 years now. So what a ride it's been with you, Bruce.
Yeah, and it's really been a lot of fun, and I still enjoy doing it, and I know you do too, Peg. And Susie,
yeah.
I think I've known you most of those 30 years, maybe not all 30, but most of it.
Well, you know what? This is my 30th year at the station as well, so we're all kind of hitting big milestones together. But, you know, Bruce, I think you offer, and Peg, such great information, so helpful. You know, I say that personally because I am constantly taking notes of things I need to do every week. Like, find this or find that, or you know what I'm saying? It's been very, very helpful to me personally, and I'm sure to our listeners.
Well, honestly, that's always been our primary intention, our primary motivation. And so congratulations to all of us, I guess. We'll see if there's a watch or a pen or any any presence in our future for 30 years. But so, Peg, as Susie mentioned, this is an open line show. People can ask us anything. Listeners will drive a lot of the show. But I know we always also come into the show with a couple of questions that we may have encountered recently that we think might have universal application. Are there any things on the forefront of your mind that you want to cover before we open it up to listeners?
Well, I thought this was a really good one because we get questions all week that go into our call line and ask, and I thought this one would be very appropriate. Here's the question we were asked. I'm worried that a friend is spending too much online sporting gambling. I'm trying to get him to focus more on saving and investments in stocks and bonds and mutual funds. He thinks there is no difference between Wall Street and the online betting. He says both are rigged casinos. How can I persuade my friend that my approach is better? Isn't that's a great question, I think, especially in today, because you hear a lot about the betting. You know, I watch football. My husband loves watching football. And we always hear about all these bets that are taking place. It could be how much this player is going to rush for this game. They've got everything from touchdown to where they're going to, you know, get how many yards, et cetera. Bruce?
Yeah, well, it is an interesting question, and it's one that I don't know that we've ever had before. And it is an issue. You know, there's some legal things going on right now. It's become so prevalent. And part of this, of course, is advances in technology and how easy it is to place a bet with your smartphone or whatever. But yeah, you're right, Peg. You can bet on almost anything. And when the coaches and the players and the people that are in the game start to participate or start to have influence on the bet, that, you know, that's an issue, that's a problem. But, you know, I find it, you know, on one level, the person that's saying, you know, either way, it's a rigged casino. I sort of understand that. Look, we're not completely naive here. Is there market manipulation that goes on? Do the wealthy, do institutional investors have certain advantages over, you know, mom and pop and their 401k plan? Absolutely. But I think that's a false equivalent to say that Wall Street and you know, gambling are equally as rigged. That does not feel appropriate or correct to me. I think the person that says that is a little misguided, Peg.
Yeah, I do too. I think you know, sports betting, I've always seen that as entertainment. It's kind of like buying lottery tickets, right? You have a long shot and you don't spend a lot of money on it. But yet here, I think more and more people are taking bigger chances and maybe not having the patience, right? So when I think about Wall Street and how we've done this show for a multitude of decades, it is a long-term wealth builder. It has been in the past. I can't talk about the future, but I don't know that we saw it as an entertainment type of thing with Wall Street. It's interesting, Bruce and Susie, that I always thought, Bruce, you mentioned it, like the big institutional people that trade, you know, us little guys, I always felt, especially early in my career, like, how do I have a chance? Well, I thought maybe let's have the big guys have their own stock market doings, and then us little people have our own, because we're not going to be trading in these large numbers. I got over that because I feel like there are benefits to us being in with the institutions in a lot of ways. So as we look at this, I encourage people to not do a lot of gambling because we still believe in slow and steady wins the race, you know, instead of like a quick dollars. And then the other thing is I participated in casinos over my lifetime. And I always saw it as an entertainment. So let's say I was in there 3 hours and I played and I made money and then I lost money, and it was an entertainment for 3 hours. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to try to hit this really, really big. So I see it completely different. Bruce?
Yeah. And with gambling, I think everybody listening knows, excuse me, the odds favor the house, right? I mean, it is set up for the house to win. But the stock market, it is true that there are periods of time where the market retracts and you can lose money. But statistically, if you look at over a long period of time, people that invest in stocks do end up performing well and making money. So it's not rigged against you where the house wins. You can win and probably will win, statistically speaking, as an investor over a long period of time. So to draw a false equivalency that, you know, whether it's the stock market or whether it's sports gambling, it's gambling either way and it's a rigged casino, that's really not fair and it's really not true. Now, the question was, how does this person convince their friend? I don't know. I think you apply that logic. I think you could say, look, I can show you that over a period of time, the stock market has averaged X percent, and I can also show you that in gambling, that the house wins X percent, whatever those numbers are, and make it logical that way. But somebody that has this idea, you may not be able to convince them, but probably the worst thing you can do is just say, look, you're wrong and I'm right. Then they're going to just shut you out. I think you have to have something, some statistical data to back up your argument.
Yeah. And hopefully this person isn't doing all the investing or the gambling for their family, you know? So if it's one person and you're only responsible for yourself, maybe you are a very high risk taker, but most people aren't. There's other people that would be affected, you know, if you continue to not win. And we've also seen a lot of movies, right, where we see where people are down and out, and it's hard to dig out of that hole. And so anyway, I wanted to talk about this one because it was a little bit off the grid, but yet I know there's a lot of people out there that do gamble, and hopefully it's not all of their resources, Bruce.
Yeah, and then finally, gambling, like you said, Peg, as a form of entertainment, I'm fine with that. As long as you understand intellectually, the house will probably win, but you enjoy playing poker, you enjoy playing blackjack, or you enjoy pulling the slots, or you enjoy betting on a sports event. It makes the event more enjoyable for you if you've got skin in the game. That's fine as entertainment, as long as it's within your budget and whatever you lose is money that you can afford to lose. And I would never look at investing that way. Investing, again, I would expect over the long term, I'm going to win. I'm going to be the winner there, whereas gambling, you're probably not. And you need to understand that and just treat it as entertainment. I'm fine with that. Peg?
Well, another one that came in, and it's kind of interesting, and I don't know how many people are paying attention, but there's a lot of cash in savings and money markets. And we all were delighted not too long ago that most of us would get north of 5% on our money markets. And that was huge. We're kind of just saying, oh, we were lucky if we got 1 or 2%. And then they jumped all the way to 5. And what happened is a lot of people accumulated cash in these money markets. But now there's about a 2% 2% lower here now from the very peak. So now money markets are like 3.4 to 3.7. And the question around this was, you know, should I start deploying these money markets into other places? Well, I do believe there's probably going to be some more interest rate cuts, and money markets will go down further if that happens again. So they're touting that in 2026, we may have some more cuts. Should you maybe be locking in? So one of the ideas that I talked about was, you know, you still have treasury bonds. And what's interesting is the 10-year treasury is close to 4.2% today. And that actually would lock you in. Not a lot of people want to go out that far on the timeline. But if you get, you know, shorter, the 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, you're going to get a lot lower than that 4.2%. But so it's kind of unknown. Then there's other types of bonds. There's municipal bonds, corporate bonds. I'm just suggesting, and I suggested to this person, that you look at your portfolio, contact your advisor. Should you be sitting in a lot of this cash, or should you be locking in some of these rates, you know, that are out on some other types of fixed income, Bruce?
So a couple thoughts, and I didn't know you were going to go down this road, Peg, but it's a good road to go down. The first thing is, yes, interest rates have fallen, but I'm still coaching a lot of my clients that if this is your safe money, if this is your rainy day money, or this is the portion of your portfolio that's set aside where your focus is on preservation and not on growth, that the interest rate is still probably a little bit higher than the rate of inflation. So you're not losing purchasing power. If rates continue to go down and or inflation goes up, and your interest rate on your safe money is lower than the inflation rate, so it's losing purchasing power, then I might give a different answer. But for most of my clients, I'm still coaching them to have the, you know, similar exposure to what they had when rates are a little bit higher. But the other thing, and I'll use myself as an example, I just did this personally, Peg. I agree with you that I think that rates are more likely, at least in the short term that we can foresee, I think rates are more likely to go down than to go up. So I did something personally called a fixed interest annuity where I get 4.9% locked in for 5 years. Now, the disadvantage is there's not liquidity. I have to make a five-year commitment. And the other disadvantage is that if interest rates go up, 4.9 sounds good today, but maybe 2 years from now, if rates go up again to over 5 or 6%, and I'm stuck at 4.9, then I'm stuck. But that was a risk I was willing to take at this point in my life. If I can get 4.9% for 5 years, to me, that was, for that portion of my portfolio, that was something I was willing to do. I was willing to give up liquidity to get that 4.9%. So there are still slightly higher rates out there than 3%, but you might have some disadvantages like a reduction of liquidity to get that. But even at 3.5%, Peg, I still think that's outpacing the inflation rate, and I still think investors are not losing purchasing power. Peg?
Yeah, and I'm glad you actually brought up annuities, because they are popular in that right now, as you mentioned, interest rates look more attractive with annuities. And also, there's a lot in the news today about guaranteed income. People are afraid that they're not going to have enough income for the rest of their lives. And that's a good place where annuities fit in. And so, Bruce, also on this 4.9 that you talked about, you probably get tax deferral if it's not in an IRA or something like that. So you get tax deferral where you don't have to get the 1099 every year for that interest, correct?
That's absolutely correct. That, and in my tax bracket, that also was appealing.
Yeah. So then another thing that happens with annuities, corporations are starting to incorporate them into their selections for 401ks. There's a lot of people out there that probably have not saved enough. And companies, corporations are trying to help and trying to provide more flexibility with their 401k or 403b dollars. And so there's annuities out there that can help you with some type of guarantee for life. And maybe it's just a percentage of your assets, but at least you know you'll have something to complement your Social Security that you wouldn't have to worry on, about it. Now, we talked about some of the pros, but there's also cons about annuities. They're touted as high fees. And if you go buy a fixed annuity from an insurance company, and they quote this 4.9%, they have all their costs really baked in. Now, there can be penalties because you may say, Bruce, you might say 1 year from now, you know what? I don't want that 4.9 anymore. I'm going to walk away. Well, there could very well be penalties for not doing the entire 5-year time frame. So you have to be careful of that. And then there's very limited liquidity on a lot of them. And yours was very straightforward. You buy an interest rate and it's for 5%. But there could be a lot of complexity where they not only just suggest or have as an option a fixed number, you can have a variable annuity, which then starts to get up and down and a lot of details about maybe you're participating in the stock market at that point. So we always highly recommend that you are knowledgeable about how that annuity works or work with your financial advisor to go through all the pros and cons. And then lastly, insurance company risk. So you need a high quality insurance company because it's not like having the money in the bank or buying a treasury, right? You're getting an IOU from this insurance company. So you got to make sure that they're very highly rated and that they have financial stability to be able to pay you back when you are requesting your money. Bruce?
Peg, anything else on your radar, or should we start with listeners?
Oh, I think we start with listeners, yes.
All right, is that my cue?
That's your cue.
A person says, what are the pros and cons of putting my 500,000 homestead in only my kids' names?
So, Peg, with the, and we've only got a couple minutes and it's break time, but I think we can get this one in. So this is a question we get a lot in terms of home ownership and owning it jointly with a kid or putting it completely in a kid's name. And there might be certain things you're trying to accomplish by doing that, but this is one of those issues that there's always going to be advantages and disadvantages or pros and cons, and it can get really complicated, Peg.
Well, one of the things about transferring is it depends on what your basis in that house is. Well, let's say you paid $100,000 for it and now it's worth $500,000. And under the current law, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bruce, but I think we each get $250,000 at death.
Yep.
And if you change that title to the kids, then that would be taxable to them. You wouldn't be able to take advantage of that. So that's probably the number one negative thing that happens with people that they don't want to transfer it. Bruce?
Well, and I asked myself, what is the advantage of doing that? Why would you, what are you trying to accomplish by transferring it completely in your kid's name? I'm not even sure why that would make sense, Peg.
Well, unless it's for nursing home or something like that, where, you know, you have a look back. If you give away an asset, it's like 5 years or three to five years before the nursing home says, no, we're going to go take that money back. Because you can make yourself look like you don't have any money, but there's a lot of rules and regulations about that too. So the only other place I see is where if you're in a nursing home, they can look at your past and see if they could pull back the value of that asset.
And the complexity of that planning in terms of protecting assets, we certainly can be value added to people and we have some expertise, but it often can get really complicated, Susie and listeners. Peg and I and other advisors at Wealth Enhancement might recommend you go see an attorney called an elder care attorney.
All right.
Susie, I know we're due for a break.
Yeah, we have a lot of questions coming in as well. This show is called Ask Bruce and Peg Anything, and that's what we're doing. A lot of questions to get to, and we'll get to all of them after a very short break. But if you are sitting there and you have a question, call this number, 651-461-9226. We'll get to as many as we can after the break. It is Your Money. It is the second half of Your Money, and we are taking your calls. Ask Bruce and Peg Anything at 651-461-9226. Bruce, should we jump right into the questions? We've got a bunch.
Yeah, I think we should. Peg, anything you wanted to hit on?
No, I think we go to questions.
All right, here's one. Love the show. Love the show. Since 1991, when I started my professional career, I've been invested in the stock market aggressively. 35 years later, I have $1.5 million. You're 100% correct. Ups and downs, but over time, market is up. 1991 was market was, question mark, 2026 market is, question mark. Great show. Listening from Waconia.
So that's nice.
Next one says income taxes and 401b Roth income tax and withheld. Let me see. Goodness sakes. That one I got wrong there. Sorry about that. These questions kind of jump all over the place. How will the additional standard deduction for seniors affect tax returns? Bruce and Peg.
So, Peg, they're probably talking about, again, that presumably, and this is going to be short-lived, I think, but it was the tax credit to offset your Social Security taxes is what I assume they're talking about.
Yeah, it's called a senior bonus, and it is limited. So it's 25, so you're going to get it for last year, 26, 27, and 28. If you're 65 plus, you both can, and if it's married filing jointly, you can both deduct the $6,000 per person. Now, it has deduction phases based on your income. So if you're joint above $150,000 and the deduction is eliminated above $250,000. So you see there's a spread there. And it's kind of like, Bruce, when the COVID happened and everybody was getting these checks. And it wasn't everybody. It was just a certain amount of people based on their returns from the past. And so this is very similar numbers-wise, phase out, all those things. And what's interesting about that, Wealth Enhancement Group advisors have to work a little harder because if you have this extra deduction, then maybe you want to pull some money out of an IRA and create some taxable income because of this extra deduction. Now, I know, Bruce, and you mentioned it, although they didn't really write that in the fine print in the thousands of pages, whatever, on all these changes, is that it was supposed to help with Social Security because 85% of your Social Security, a large percentage of people have to put that on their income tax. And that's taxable. So it raises, you know, are you in the 15% bracket? Are you in the 30? All of those things. So if you get these deductions, it's supposed to help you stay in a lower bracket. But what we'll probably work on harder, even we did in 2025, is to try to take advantage of getting that extra right now. And maybe you're able to pull out of an IRA or do some other financial planning because of it. Bruce?
Yeah, there is a planning opportunity because of this law. And kind of what comes to mind for me is, it's like Roth conversion, or it's like a lot of the planning that we do. Peg, you always emphasize the fact that people want immediate gratification, meaning they don't want to pay an extra penny in taxes this year if they can help it. But what we've had to coach people is that we're looking at minimizing taxes over a lifetime. And sometimes you might be better off paying a little bit more in tax today to pay a lot less in the future, and to pay net less over your lifetime. And that's a hard concept for a lot of people to get comfortable with, but a lot of the planning we do actually focuses around that. Because if we can, it's not the total amount of return on investment, it's the amount that you get to keep. And there's a lot of planning opportunities, particularly after you retire, to mitigate some of those taxes. You know, when you think about it, when you're working, your paycheck is your paycheck, and there's not a lot you can do. You can contribute to your company retirement plan with pre-tax dollars. But when you think about retirement income, what makes up the income? It's not just a paycheck. It might be Social Security. It might be pension. It might be income from investments, but those are all taxed differently. There's tax-deferred plans. There's tax advantage like Roth. There's taxable investments. So what makes up your retirement income can be a lot of different things, and they're all taxed differently, and therein lies the planning opportunities. And that's what I thought of as you gave your answer about this short-term tax credit. Anything else, Peg?
Well, the only other thing was is that your children could possibly be very mad at you. You know, they could be mad at you because if you leave that taxation for them, somebody's going to pay the taxes at some point. Susie?
651-461-9226. The texter writes, I wanted to take all my dividends that I got in December and use that for monthly income in 2026. Wondering, is that a good way to do it, or should I just leave it in my funds and systematically withdraw it?
Oh, wow. What a good question. So, Peg, let me give a little more context, and I'll let you kind of answer. So this idea of dividends, so there's a couple of issues here. Number one, if you recognize the dividends, you know, in the tax year 2025, is that better or do you want to recognize them in 2026? So that's one thing we would look at. But typically on investments, the dividends end up being reinvested in buying more shares of the investment, whatever it is, funds, stocks, whatever the portfolio is. But one of the things that we look at again in retirement income planning is, rather than reinvest those dividends, maybe you want to use them for income for retirement lifestyle. Maybe you want to just reduce the risk of your portfolio and take those dividends and put them in the money market or cash. So there's a lot of moving parts here, Peg.
Yeah, I'm a big fan if it's like a deferred account, like an IRA, 401k, that kind of thing, because you're kind of building your wealth for the future, or maybe you're not, but yet you may be coming up to that required minimum distribution and 73 years old, and maybe you want to use the dividends for that. So IRAs and 401ks are a little different in my mind that a lot of times I'll suggest reinvesting. The dividends on money, after-tax money that you've invested already, you've paid tax on that money, and you're getting these dividends. I'm a bigger fan of taking those dividends to the degree that maybe you need it for income. Why not? You know, why reinvest all of it and then just pull out an income stream pro rata on all of it? We tend to be a little bit more detailed as to, okay, where should we take that money from? Now, a lot of the advisors at Wealth Enhancer Group put that dividend money in a pool if you don't need it. And then maybe there's a better place to put it than just automatically kind of do it, forget it. So we do a lot more hands-on, I would call, a managing of that portfolio. And it's not necessarily us as advisors. Remember, I keep talking about the 50-plus people that work in our investment team. They do a lot of this for us, and I'm so grateful that they do it. But yet we're talking to the clients about, here's a good strategy for you, which is tailored to you. Bruce?
Yeah, and again, this leads me back to retirement income planning, which is one of what I think our biggest value added is to our clients. When you retire, where's your income going to come from? What's the smartest place to take your money from this year? So based on how much you want, the investments that you have, we're going to look at tax ramifications. We're going to look at investment results, and we're going to determine the smartest money this year comes from bucket A or bucket B or A and B, and you leave C and D alone. And it may change from year to year. Maybe next year C and D are the buckets you want to use. But that type of planning to know to how to spend the smartest money first is something that, frankly, Peg, a lot of our industry doesn't do. Everybody in our space can help people grow their money, can help them invest their money. We all do that, but a lot of advisory firms don't want you to spend your money. In fact, frankly, they'd rather you leave it with them. But we understand at Wealth Enhancement that the reason you saved and invested and worked so hard was to have a certain lifestyle at retirement. So we will help you spend it and spend it as wisely as possible. In fact, Peg, we've even done shows where we talk about, we encourage our clients to spend their money that aren't spending it, to go do their bucket list things, to go take that trip, to go spoil that grandchild or whatever. If you have the economic wherewithal, go spend your money and enjoy life, and we'll help you spend the smartest money first. Peg?
Yeah, I love that about us, that we just say, go do things. The other thing I was thinking about when you were talking about this is that money matrix that we created decades ago, and how it just helps streamline where the money is going to come from. And so the stock market is at a high point today, right? There's this magnificent seven that's just doing so well, and we've got AI companies, and they've we had double digit returns in 2025. You know, this may be a time that you want to contact your advisor, or if you're not working with an advisor, contact somebody, because I think, you know, and you're getting closer to retirement and you got to create your own paychecks. That's where, you know, we have so much experience in creating these paychecks for people. And Bruce, I love what you said about, we allow them to go live. You know, we're like pushing them out the door, telling them, go on this vacation. Don't feel bad about it. And so I just wanted to add that 2 cents.
I don't want to hijack the show from the listeners, but you just went kind of down a road that maybe we should go down. You mentioned AI and the big seven and their investments in AI. Peg, one of the questions I'm getting from a lot of people, so I think this is going to be relevant to a lot of listeners, whether anyone was going to ask it today or not, but I keep hearing about people are afraid of an AI bubble. And how do they protect themselves from this potential pullback or retraction in the market because of an AI bubble? Are you hearing that? And how would you respond to that?
There's no question that we're hearing that. And, you know, number one, the seven stocks are Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, platforms, NVIDIA, and Tesla. Those were the seven. And the total return on those, the 10 years, just over the top, right? So you kind of wonder whether you want to, you know, invest more in them, or you want to continue to invest in them, because that's probably where our future is going. So we're getting that question a lot. But you still have to diversify. That's a big point, is that you can't just go buy those seven and live happily ever after. You have to have a well-diversified portfolio. And so we're trying to get people to make sure that they have a balanced portfolio, not only domestic, but also some international out there. You know, there's years that the U.S., you know, wins, and there's years that the other countries, the European countries, are doing well. But I think, Bruce, that tech is still going to be a big deal, especially with this AI and the deployment. Now, a lot of the AI today and what these companies are working on is all the back, kind of the corporate back office things that they're doing, rolling out, which is creating, believe it or not, it's creating a lot of efficiency. It's allowing advisors definitely to have more time, even more time with their clients than trying to do all this backdoor, you know, paperwork and things. So, Bruce, I still think people should invest in it, but not be just focused on that AI, because to me, that's a risky roller coaster. Bruce?
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, I've gotten, at times in my career, I've had people question that they're disappointed in their return. And they might say, well, the S&P 500, which would include these seven companies or the Dow 30 or whatever, domestic large cap stocks did really well. Why did you guys have money in global stocks and small cap stocks and other sectors or other investments that you shot yourself in the foot? And my answer always is, but we're diversifying because that asset class, whether it's AI or whether it's technology or large cap domestic stocks, is not always going to be the best asset class every year. So we diversify the portfolio with exposure to a lot of different things to get a competitive risk-adjusted return. And again, our focus is always on the client, not necessarily getting the highest possible return, but getting the return that they need to meet their goals and objectives and to get that return with the least amount of risk possible. Very rarely is my goal with a client to say, I'm going to get you the highest return possible. I'm going to get you 30% a year or some crazy thing like that. It's to determine what return they need to hit their goals and objectives, and then how do we get that with the least amount of risk. So, again, diversification is one of the keys of how we do that. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter writes, I'm 68 years old. I'm still working full-time, but started Medicare a year ago. I have about $25,000 in my HSA. Does it make sense to use my health savings account, or HSA, to pay my monthly Medicare premium? Thankfully, I'm very healthy, and I have minimal medical expenses.
Peg, so this, again, is a question that's not uncommon. When do you use the HSA? What do you use it for? We've talked a lot on this show what a great strategy it is, and people should be using it. But when do you spend it?
Yeah, I love the tax-free. So the money that I put in my HSA, it's tax-free. And when I pull it out, provided that I'm using it for the limited amounts of our things that we can use it for, like Medicare, long-term care, that actually then it's tax-free. So it's probably one of the best investments you can make tax-free and tax-free. So because it's tax-free, I tend to be a hoarder maybe of tax-free, because I don't get a lot of tax-free. So I tend to suggest to my clients that they save that money and use it for things like this Medicare premium. But if that's, if you're only 68, this is where I have a fear. If you're only 68, you have years to go. And maybe it would be a good idea to still kind of build that portfolio because it is tax-free. Now, it's all based on your health and maybe your hereditary, family unit, that kind of thing. I wouldn't just go deplete it as soon as possible. That's just my opinion, Bruce.
Yeah, and I don't, to the texter's question, using it for that, I'm not opposed to that at all. I'm of the opinion for myself that somewhere in my future, there's probably knee replacement surgeries or hip replacement surgeries. And I'm sort of like you, Peg, I'm hoarding the money for these big ticket items that I expect or anticipate are, if not likely, certainly possible in the future. But it's a fair question, and it's a tricky one. And it's one of those things, you know, if we had a crystal ball, financial planning would be so much easier. But the HSA is definitely an effective tool. When you spend it or how you use it is never going to be an exact science. But I'm not opposed to using it, you know, to pay Medicare Part B premiums. That's fine if that's what you want to do. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. A texter says, it seems the default scenario is always married and filing jointly. This never applies to me. What percent of your clients are single or married filing separately?
Oh, wow. What a good question, Peg. I'm hoping that you can bail us out, because I will readily admit at the outset, I don't know the answer. I'm also of the opinion that the vast majority of the time, if you're married and you have a choice of filing individually or married filing jointly, that almost always married filing jointly is going to be better. But I'm not sure if that's right, and I'm not sure why that's right if it is. Peg, do you know?
Yeah. So I also see married filing jointly most of the time. And and many tax people, including Wealth Enhancer Group, run it two different ways, right? So you can see if there's an advantage. A lot of it has to do with, you know, if one is working and one isn't working, that's usually a disadvantage. And so married filing jointly usually works in that favor. And then for single people, you know, single is single, right? So there's not a lot to talk about there. But I don't know. We see so many tax returns, and it's the lion's share of it is married filing jointly, including myself.
All right. Can I ask this follow-up about HSA funds from a texter? Can you buy long-term care policy with HSA funds, Peg?
Well, you can pay for it.
Yeah.
I do know that we're ending up paying out of it to pay the $8,000 a month contribution. Do you know, Bruce, off the top of your head? I forget.
We have about a minute.
No, I was hoping you knew. That's one we could probably look up pretty quick, but not less than a minute we have left.
We can do it next time. Because that's, you know, if people have them, I wonder if they're not using them for money things, can they use them for other things? I mean, health things, can they use them for other things?
Well, if it's, you can always use the money, Susie, but if it doesn't meet what they call qualifying healthcare expenses, then you have to pay the taxes on the gains.
Okay.
Anything that qualifies, then you avoid the taxes. But and sometimes I'm not sure what meets that definition and what doesn't. That's what we'll come back with and address next week.
That's great. We're almost out of time. Have a great week, guys, and look forward to next week. It's your money. Thanks, guys. And if you did not get your question answered, you can email it to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com or call 1-888-6-ADVICE, 1-888-6-ADVICE.